to think that Dog Door was the same as Bad Dog, which was very disappointing, to say the least. Obviously, this had been a very upsetting day for everybody, and I was certainly willing to put the whole incident behind us. But when Dad came home, Mom and the boy talked to him, and he yelled, and I knew he was mad at me. I slunk off into the living room and ignored Smokey's snide expression. Dad and the boy left right after dinner. Mom sat at the table and stared at papers, even when I approached and put a wonderful wet ball in her lap. "Oh, yuck, Bailey," she said. When the boy and Dad came home, the boy called me out into the garage and showed me a big wooden box. He climbed inside, so I joined him, though the space was hot and tight with the two of us in there. "Doghouse, Bailey, this is your doghouse." I didn't see how the box related to me, but I was certainly happy to play doghouse when treats were introduced into the mix. Doghouse meant go inside the doghouse and eat the dog biscuit. We did the doghouse trick and the dog door trick while Dad moved around the garage, placing things up on shelves and tying a rope on the big metal container. I was overjoyed that dog door had treats associated with it again. When the boy grew tired of tricks, we went inside and wrestled on the floor. "Time for bed," Mom said. "Oh, Mom, please, can I stay up?" "We both have school tomorrow, Ethan. Time for you to say goodnight to Bailey." While conversations like this took place in the house all the time, I rarely bothered to pay attention. But this time I lifted my head at my name, sensing a shift in the boy's emotions. A sadness and regret wafted off him, and he stood, his shoulders slumped. "Okay, Bailey, time for bed." I knew what bed was, but apparently we were going to take a detour along the way, because the boy led me out to the garage for another rousing game of doghouse. I was perfectly fine with this, but shocked when moments later the boy sealed me back in the garage, all by myself. I barked, trying to make sense of it all. Was it because I'd chewed up my dog bed? I never slept in the thing anyway. It was just for show. Did they really expect me to remain outside in the garage all night? No, that couldn't be it. Could it? I was so distressed, I couldn't help but whimper. The thought of the boy lying in bed without me, all alone, made me so sad I wanted to chew shoes. My cries grew louder, my heartbreak unrestrained. After 10 or 15 minutes of relentless grief, the garage door cracked. "Bailey," the boy whispered. I ran to him in relief. He eased out, carrying a blanket and a pillow. "Okay, doghouse, doghouse," he told me. He crept over to the doghouse and arranged the blanket on the thin pad inside. I climbed in next to him. We both had 2 feet sticking out the door. I put my head on his chest, sighing, while he stroked my ears. "Good dog, Bailey," he murmured. A little while later, Mom and Dad opened the door from the house and stood there, watching us. I flapped my tail but didn't get up, not wanting to wake the boy. Finally, Dad came out and picked up Ethan, and Mom gestured to me, and the two of us were put to bed inside the house. The next day, as if we hadn't learned anything from our mistakes, I was out in the garage again. This time there was far less for me to do, though I did with some effort manage to tear the pad out of the doghouse and shred it up pretty well. I knocked over the trash container, but couldn't get the lid off. Nothing on the shelves was chewable. Nothing I could reach, anyway. At one point I went over and assaulted the flap over the dog door, my nose picking up the rich scent of an oncoming rainstorm. Compared to the yard, where a dry, sandy dust had coated our parched tongues every day, the place the boy lived was wetter and colder, and I loved the way scents would blur together and reform when it rained. Wonderful trees, laden with leaves, sheltered the ground everywhere we went, and they would harbor raindrops and release them later when tossed by breezes. It was all so deliciously moist. Even the hottest days were usually broken by cooler air at night. The tantalizing odors drew my head farther and farther through the dog door until suddenly, quite by accident, I was out in the yard, without the boy having to push me. Delighted, I tore around the backyard barking. It was as if the dog door had been put there to let me out into the backyard from the garage. I squatted and relieved myself. I was finding I much preferred doing my business outdoors instead of in the house, and not just because of the lack of drama. I liked to wipe my paws on the lawn after I went, trailing the scent from the sweat on my pads onto the blades of grass. It was also much more gratifying to lift my leg and mark the edge of the yard than, say, the corner of the couch. Later, when the cold rain turned from mist to serious drops, I discovered the dog door worked both ways. I wished the boy were home so he could see what I had taught myself. After the rain ended, I dug a hole, chewed the hose, and barked at Smokey, who sat in the window and pretended not to hear me. When a large yellow bus pulled up in front of the house and disgorged the boy and Chelsea and a bunch of other kids from the neighborhood, I was in the backyard, my paws up on the fence, and the boy ran up to me laughing. I didn't really go into the doghouse after that, except when Mom and Dad yelled at each other. Ethan would come out into the garage and get into the doghouse with me and put his arms around me, and I would sit perfectly still for however long he wanted me to. This was, I decided, my purpose as a dog, to comfort the boy whenever he needed me. Sometimes families would leave the neighborhood and new families would arrive, so when Drake and Todd moved in a few houses down, I considered it nothing but good news, and not just because Mom made delicious cookies to take to the new neighbors, feeding me a couple as a reward for keeping her company in the kitchen. New boys meant more children to play with. Drake was older and bigger than Ethan, but Todd was the same age, and he and Ethan became fast friends. Todd and Drake had a sister named Linda, who was even younger. She fed me sugary treats when no one was watching. Todd was different from Ethan. He liked to play games in the creek with matches, burning plastic toys like Linda's dolls. Ethan would participate, but he didn't laugh as much as Todd. Mostly, Ethan just watched the things burn. When Todd announced he had firecrackers one day, Ethan got pretty excited. I had never seen anything like a firecracker and was pretty startled at the flash and the noise and the way the plastic doll instantly had a smoky smell, or at least the part I could find after the explosion. At Todd's urging, Ethan went into his house and came back with one of the toys he had built with his father, and the boys put a firecracker in it and threw it in the air, and it blew up.
"Cool!"
Todd yelled. But Ethan just grew quiet, frowning at the little shards of plastic floating away in the creek. I sensed a jumble of confused emotions from him. When Todd tossed firecrackers up into the air and one came down near me, the percussion snapped against my side. I ran over to the boy for reassurance, and he hugged me and took me home. Having such easy access to the backyard had some advantages. Ethan wasn't always particularly attentive to the fence gate, which meant I sometimes was free to stroll the neighborhood. I'd trot out and go over to visit the brown and white dog named Marshmallow, who lived in a big wire cage on the side of her house. I marked her trees pretty well, and sometimes, caught by a scent that was both foreign and familiar, I would skip off, nose to the air, and wander from home on an adventure. During those wanderings, I sometimes forgot about the boy altogether, and I was reminded of the time several of us were taken from the yard to the cool room with the nice lady, how the front seat dog had a provocative odor similar to the one luring me onward. Usually I lost the scent and then would remember who I was and turn and trot home. The days that the bus brought Ethan home, I would go with him over to Chelsea and Marshmallow's house, and Chelsea's mother would feed Ethan snacks, which he always shared with me. Other days, Ethan came home in Mom's car. And some days, no one in the house got up for school, and I would have to bark to wake them all up. It was a good thing they no longer wanted me to sleep in the garage. I would hate for them to miss the morning. One day I wandered farther than usual, so that when I headed back toward home, it was getting late in the afternoon. I was anxious, my inner clock telling me that I had already missed Ethan's arrival on the bus. I cut through the creek, which took me right past Todd's backyard. He was playing on the muddy bank, and when he saw me, he called to me. "Hey, Bailey. Here, Bailey." He held out his hand to me. I regarded him with open suspicion. There was just something different about Todd, something inside of him I didn't trust. "Come on, boy," he said, slapping his hand against his leg. He turned and walked toward his house. What could I do? I was compelled to do what a person told me. I lowered my head and followed. Chapter 8. Todd let me in his house through the back door, shutting it noiselessly behind him. Some of the windows were covered, giving the place a dark, gloomy feel. Todd led me past the kitchen, where his mother was sitting and watching a flickering television. I knew from Todd's behavior that I was supposed to be quiet, but I thumped my tail a little when I smelled the mother, who carried a strong chemical odor similar to the man who had found me by the road and named me Fella. The mother didn't see us, but Linda sure did. She sat upright when we walked past her in the living room. She, too, was watching television, but she slid off the couch and made to follow us down the hallway.
"No,"
Todd hissed at her. I certainly knew that word. I cringed a little at the venom in Todd's voice. Linda held her hand out, and I licked it, and Todd pushed it away.
"Leave me alone."
He opened a door, and I went inside, sniffing at the clothes on the floor. It was a small room with a bed in it. He'd locked the door behind us. I found a crust of bread and ate it quickly, just performing a quick clean-up. Todd pushed his hands into his pockets. "Okay," he said. "Okay, now." He sat at his desk and opened a drawer. I could smell firecrackers in there. The pungent odor was unmistakable. "I don't know where Bailey is," he was saying quietly. "I haven't seen Bailey." I wagged at my name, then yawned and collapsed on a soft pile of clothing. I was tired from my long adventure. A tiny knock on the door electrified Todd, who leaped to his feet. I jumped up, too, and stood behind him while he whispered angrily out his door at Linda, whom I could smell more than see in the dark hallway. She seemed both scared and concerned for some reason, making me anxious. I started to pant a little, yawning nervously. I felt too tense to lie back down. The conversation ended with Todd slamming his door and locking it again. I watched as he went to his drawer, fished around, and brought out a small tube. He was emanating an agitated excitement. He removed the top and took a tentative sniff while heavy chemical vapors instantly filled the room. I knew the astringent odor from when the boy and Dad would sit at the table and play with their airplane toys. When Todd shoved it at me, I already knew I didn't want my nose anywhere near the tube, and I jerked my head away. I sensed the flash of rage in Todd, and it frightened me. He picked up a cloth and dripped a lot of clear liquid from the tube onto it, folding and squeezing the cloth so that the sticky coating was all over it. Just then, I heard Ethan, a plaintive cry from outside the window. "Bailey!" he was calling. I ran to the window and jumped up, but it was too high for me to see out, so I barked in frustration. My rear end stung as Todd struck it with an open palm.
"No! Bad dog, no barking!"
Again, the heat of his fury flowed off him as strong as the vapors coming from the cloth in his hand.
"Todd!"
a woman called from somewhere in the house. He gave me a mean look.
"You stay here. You stay!"
he hissed. He backed out of the room, shutting the door behind him. My eyes watering at the fumes that still filled the air, I paced around apprehensively. The boy was calling me, and I couldn't figure out how Todd had the right to keep me locked up in here as if it were the garage. Then a small sound alerted me. Linda was opening the door, holding out a soggy cracker.
"Here, Billy," she whispered. "Good dog."
What I really wanted was out of there, but I was no idiot. I ate the cracker. Linda held the door open wider.
"Come on," she urged.
And that was all I needed. I bounded down the hallway after her, turning down some stairs and trotting to the front door. She pushed it open, and the cool air washed those horrible fumes right out of my head. Mom's car was down the street, and the boy was leaning out of it, calling, "Bailey!" I took off as fast as I could in hot pursuit. The car's taillights flashed brightly, and Ethan was out on the street running to me.
"Oh, Bailey, where have you been?"
he said, burying his face in my fur.
"You are a bad, bad dog."
I knew being a bad dog was wrong, but the love pouring out of the boy was so strong I couldn't help but feel that in this case, being a bad dog was somehow good. It wasn't long after my adventure at Todd's house that I was taken on a car ride to see a man in a clean, cool room. I realized I'd been to a similar place before. Dad drove Ethan and me to the place, and from Dad's attitude I got the sense that I was somehow being punished, which hardly seemed fair. If anyone belonged in the cool room, in my opinion, it was Todd. He was mean to Linda, and he kept me apart from my boy. It wasn't my fault I had been a bad dog. Nonetheless, I wagged and lay quietly when a needle was slipped into my fur behind my head. When I awoke, I was stiff, sore, and itchy, with a familiar ache low in my belly, and I was wearing a stupid plastic collar, so that my face lay at the bottom of a cone again. Smokey clearly felt this was hilarious, so I did my best to ignore him. In fact, nothing felt better than lying on the cold cement floor of the garage for a few days, my rear legs splayed. After the collar came off and I was back to my old self, I found that I was less interested in pursuing exotic odors outside the fence, though if the gate was left open, I was always happy to explore the neighborhood and see what all the other dogs were up to. I stayed away from Todd's end of the street, though, and if I saw him or his brother Drake playing in the creek, I usually shied away from them, slinking into the shadows the way my first mother had taught me. I was learning new words every day. Besides being a good dog, and sometimes a bad dog, I was being told more and more that I was a big dog, which to me mostly meant that I was finding it harder and harder to arrange myself comfortably on the boy's bed. I learned that snow, which sounded so much like no, but was shouted joyously, meant that the world was coated in a cold white coat. Sometimes we went sledding down a long, steep road, and I usually tried to stay on the sled with Ethan until we crashed. And spring meant warm weather and longer days, and that Mom spent all weekend digging in the backyard and planting flowers, the dirt smelling so wonderful that when everyone went to school, I dug the flowers up, chewing the bittersweet blossoms out of a sense of loyal obligation to Mom, though I eventually spat them all out. That day I was a bad dog again, for some reason, and even had to spend the evening out in the garage instead of lying at Ethan's feet while he worked on his papers. Then one day the kids on the big yellow bus were so loud I could hear them shrieking 5 minutes before the thing stopped in front of the house. The boy was full of joy when he burst out and ran up to me, his mood so high that I ran around and around in circles barking extravagantly. We went to Chelsea's house, and I played with Marshmallow, and Mom was happy when she came home, too. And from that time on, the boy didn't go to school anymore, and we could lie in bed quietly instead of getting up for breakfast with Dad. Life had finally gotten back to normal. I was happy. One day we took a long, long car ride, and when we were done, we were at the farm. A whole new place with animals and smells I'd never before encountered. Two older people came out of a big white house when we pulled into the driveway. Ethan called them Grandma and Grandpa, and Mom did too, though later I also heard her call them Mom and Dad, which I dismissed as mere confusion on her part. There were so many things to do on the farm that the boy and I spent the first few days on a dead run. An enormous horse stared at me from over a fence when I approached, though she was unwilling to play or do anything but look blankly at me, even when I climbed under the fence and barked at her. Instead of a creek, there was a pond, big and deep enough for Ethan and me to swim in. A family of ducks lived on its banks and drove me crazy by taking to the water and paddling away when I approached. But then the mother duck would swim back toward me whenever I grew tired of barking at them, and so I'd bark some more. In the scheme of things, I put ducks right down there with Smokey the Cat when it came to their value to the boy and myself. Dad left after a few days, but Mom stayed with us on the farm that whole summer. She was happy. Ethan slept on the porch, a room on the front of the house, and I slept right with him, and no one even pretended the arrangement should be different. Grandpa liked to sit in a chair and scratch my ears, and Grandma was always slipping me little treats. The love from them made me squirm with joy. There was no yard, just a big open field with a fence designed to let me in and out at any point I desired, like the world's longest dog door, only without a flap. The horse, whose name was Flair, stayed inside the fence and spent the day eating grass, though I never saw her throw up once. The piles she left in the yard smelled as if they'd taste pretty good, but were actually dry and bland, so I only ate a couple of them. Having the run of the place meant I could explore the woods on the other side of the fence, or run down and play in the pond, or do just about anything I pleased. I mostly stuck close to the house, though, because Grandma seemed to be cooking delicious meals almost every minute of every day, and needed me to be on hand to taste her concoctions to make sure they were acceptable. I was glad to do my part. The boy liked to put me in the front of the rowboat and push it out in the pond, drop a worm into the water, and pull out a small wriggling fish for me to bark at. He would then let it go. "It's too little, Bailey," he always said. "But one of these days we'll catch a big one. You watch." Eventually I discovered, much to my disappointment, that the farm had a cat, a black one, who lived in an old collapsing building called the barn. She always watched me, crouched in the darkness, whenever I took it into my head to go in there and try to sniff her out. This cat seemed afraid of me, and therefore was a major improvement over Smokey, just like everything at this place. And one day I thought I saw the black cat in the woods, and took off in hot pursuit, though she was waddling slowly, and as I got closer, revealed that she was something else entirely, a whole new animal, with white stripes down her black body. Delighted, I barked at her, and she turned and gave me a solemn look, her fluffy black tail held high up in the air. She wasn't running, which I figured meant she wanted to play. But when I jumped in to paw at her, the animal did a most curious thing, turning away from me, her tail still in the air. The next thing I knew, a plume of horrid smell enveloped my nose, stinging my eyes and lips. Blinded, yelping, I retreated, wondering what in the world had just happened. "Skunk," Grandpa announced when I scratched at the door to be let in.
"Oh, you're not coming in, Bailey."
"Bailey, did you get into a skunk?" Mom asked me through the screen door.
"Ugh, you sure did."
I didn't know this word, skunk, but I knew that something very odd had occurred out there in the woods, and it was followed by something odder still. Wrinkling up his nose at me, the boy took me out into the yard and wetted me down with a hose. He held my head while Grandma carted up a basket of tomatoes from the garden and squeezed the tart juices all over my fur, turning it red. I couldn't see how any of this help matters any, particularly since I was then subjected to the indignity of what Ethan informed me was a bath. Perfumed soap was rubbed into my wet fur until I smelled like a cross between Mom and a tomato. I had never been so thoroughly humiliated in my life. When I was dry, I was consigned to the porch, and though Ethan slept out there with me, he kicked me out of his bed. "You stink, Bailey," he said. The assault on my person, thus complete, I lay on the floor and tried to sleep, despite the riot of odors wafting around the room. When morning finally came, I ran down to the pond and rolled in a dead fish that had washed up on shore, but not even that helped much. I still smelled like perfume. Eager to figure out what had happened, I went back into the woods to see if I could find that cat-like animal and get an explanation. Now that I knew her scent, she wasn't hard to locate, but I'd hardly begun to sniff at her when the same exact thing happened, a blinding spray that hit me from, of all places, the animal's rear end. I couldn't figure out how to resolve this misunderstanding, and wondered if I wouldn't be better off just ignoring the animal altogether, making her suffer for all the ignominy she had put me through. In fact, that's exactly what I decided to do once I trotted home and was put through the entire cycle of washings and tomato juice dunkings again. Was this my life now? Every day I'd be slathered in vegetables, have stinky soaps rubbed into me, and be barred from entry into the main part of the house, even when Grandma was cooking. "You are so stupid, Bailey," the boy scolded me while he scrubbed me out in the yard. "Don't use the word stupid. It is such an ugly word," Grandma said. "Tell him? Tell him he's a doodle. That's what my mother always called me when I was a little girl, and I did something wrong." The boy faced me sternly. "Bailey, you are a doodle dog. You are a doodle doodle dog." And then he laughed, and Grandma laughed, but I was so miserable I could barely move my tail. Fortunately, around about the time that the smells faded from my fur, the family stopped behaving so strangely and allowed me to rejoin them. The boy sometimes called me a doodle dog, but never angrily, more as an alternative to my name. "Want to go fishing, doodle dog?" he'd ask, and we'd shove out in the rowboat and pull tiny fish out of the water for a few hours. One day, toward the very end of summer, it was colder than usual, and we were out in the boat, Ethan wearing a hood that was attached to his shirt at the neck, and suddenly he jumped up. "I've got a big one, Bailey, a big one!" I responded to his excitement, leaping to my feet and barking. He wrestled with his rod for more than a minute, grinning and laughing, and then I saw it, a fish the size of a cat, coming to the surface right next to our boat. Ethan and I both leaned forward to see it. The boat rocked, and then with a yell, the boy fell overboard. I leaped to the side of the boat and stared down into the dark green water. I could see the boy vanishing from sight, and the bubbles rising to the surface carried his scent to me, but he showed no signs of resurfacing. I didn't hesitate. I dove right in after him, my eyes open as I pushed against the water and struggled to follow the trail of bubbles down into the cold darkness. Chapter 9. I couldn't see much of anything down there in the water, which pressed against my ears and slowed my desperate descent. I could sense the boy, though, sinking slowly ahead of me. I swam even harder, finally catching blurry sight of him. It was almost like my first vision of Mother, a smeared image in murky shadows. I lunged, jaws open, and when I was right up to him, I was able to seize the hood of his sweatshirt in my mouth. I lifted my head and, dragging him with me, rose as quickly as I could toward the sunlit surface of the pond. We burst up into the air.
"Bailey!"
the boy shouted, laughing.
"Are you trying to save me, boy?"
He reached out and snagged the boat with his arm. Frantically, I tried to claw my way up his body and into the boat so I could pull him the rest of the way to safety. He was still laughing.
"Bailey, no, you doodle dog, stop it!"
He pushed me away, and I swam a tight circle.
"I have to get the rod, Bailey. I dropped the rod. I'm okay. Go on, I'm okay. Go on."
The boy gestured toward the shore as if he were throwing a ball in that direction. He seemed to want me to leave the pond. So after a minute I did, aiming for the small area of sand next to the dock.
"Good boy, Bailey,"
he said encouragingly. I looked around and saw his feet go up in the air, and then an instant later he vanished under the water. With a whimper, I turned right around and swam as hard as I could, my shoulders lifting clear out of the pond with the effort. When I got to the trail of bubbles, I followed the scent. It was much harder to get myself down this time because I hadn't dived out of the boat, and as I was headed toward the bottom of the pond, I sensed the boy coming up, and I switched directions.
"Bailey!"
he called delightedly. He tossed his rod into the boat.
"You are such a good dog, Bailey."
I swam beside him as he pulled the boat over to the sand, so relieved I licked his face when he bent over to haul the boat out of the shore.
"You really tried to save me, boy."
I sat, panting, and he stroked my face. The sun and his touch warmed me in equal measure. The next day, the boy brought Grandpa down to the dock. It was much hotter than it had been the day before, and racing ahead of the two of them, I made sure the duck family was out in the middle of the pond where it belonged. The boy was wearing another shirt with a hood, and the three of us trotted to the end of the dock and looked down into the green water. The ducks swam over to see what we were looking at, and I pretended I knew.
"You watch. He'll dive underwater, I promise," the boy said.
"I'll believe it when I see it,"
Grandpa replied. We walked back to the shore side of the dock. Grandpa grabbed my collar.
"Go!"
he shouted. The boy took off running, and after only a second, Grandpa released me so I could follow. Ethan sailed off the end of the dock and made a huge splash, which the ducks complained about to each other, bobbing in the waves. I ran to the end of the dock and barked, and then looked back at Grandpa.
"Go get him, Bailey,"
Grandpa urged. I looked down at the frothy water where the boy had gone in, then back at Grandpa. He was old and moved pretty slow, but I couldn't believe he was so daft that he wasn't going to do anything about this new situation. I barked some more.
"Go on,"
Grandpa told me. I suddenly understood and looked at him in disbelief. Did I have to do everything in this family? With one more bark, I dove off the end of the dock, swimming down toward the bottom, where I could sense Ethan lying motionless. I gripped his collar in my jaws and headed for air.
"See? He saved me,"
the boy called when we both surfaced.
"Good boy, Bailey,"
Grandpa and the boy shouted together. Their praise pleased me so much, I took off after the ducks, who quacked stupidly as they swam away. I got so close to being able to nip off a few tail feathers that a couple of them flapped their wings and briefly took flight, which meant I won, in my opinion. The rest of the afternoon was spent playing Rescue Me, and my anxiety gradually dissipated as I learned that the boy could pretty much fend for himself in that pond, though it so delighted him whenever I hauled him to the surface, I dove after him every single time. The ducks eventually climbed out of the water and sat by the edge of the pond, and watched us without comprehension. Why they didn't fly up into the trees with the other birds, I'd never understand. I could see no reason to ever leave the farm. But when Dad arrived a few days later and Mom started walking from room to room, opening drawers and pulling things out, I had a feeling we were going to move yet again, and began pacing anxiously, afraid I'd be left behind. It wasn't until the boy called, "Car ride!" that I was allowed to climb in and hang my head out the window. The horse, Flair, stared at me with what I assumed was unrestrained jealousy, and both Grandma and Grandpa hugged me before we drove away. We wound up going back home, and I was delighted to reacquaint myself with the kids and dogs in the neighborhood, but not Smokey. We played games, and I chased balls and wrestled with my friend Marshmallow, so busy having fun, I was completely unprepared for the morning a few days later when we all got up early, and I found myself being unceremoniously led out to the garage. I immediately ran out the dog door and confirmed that Ethan and Mom were both leaving, Ethan taking off with the rest of the children in the same yellow bus. Well, this was intolerable. I barked for a while, and from down the street Marshmallow answered, so we barked at each other, but that didn't help as much as you'd think. I moodily went back into the garage, sniffing with disdain at the doghouse. I would not spend my day in there, I decided, even though it was the softest place around. I saw Smokey's feet underneath the door and put my nose to the crack and inhaled his scent, letting out a frustrated sigh. I didn't sense a lot of sympathy coming from him. Because I was a big dog now, the doorknob was easily within reach, and it occurred to me that there was something I could do about my predicament. I put my paws on the door, took the knob in my mouth, and twisted it. Nothing happened, but I kept trying, and eventually, with a small click, the door fell open. Smokey had been sitting on the other side, probably laughing, but when I saw him, he sure wasn't laughing anymore. His pupils grew dark, and he turned and fled, so naturally I followed him, skittering around the corner and barking when he leaped up on the counter. It was much better in the house. The night before, pizza dinner had arrived at the front door in a long flat box, which was still sitting on the counter and therefore easily accessible. I pulled it onto the floor and ate the delicious cardboard, shredding the less flavorful parts, while Smokey watched in feigned disgust. Then I ate a can of his cat food, licking the metal clean. Normally, I wasn't allowed to sleep on the couch, but I couldn't see any reason to follow that rule, since clearly everything had changed now that I was inside the house by myself. I settled in for a nice nap, my head on a soft pillow, the sun warm on my back. Sometime later, I realized the sun had moved, which was most inconvenient, and I changed positions on the couch, groaning. Not long after that, I heard the distinctive sound of one of the kitchen cupboards opening and raced in to see what was happening. Smokey was on the counter and had reached up and opened a door, which I thought was extremely enterprising of him. I watched intently as he leaped inside the cupboard, his tiny nose sniffing at the delicious items inside. He looked down at me, calculating something. I decided to bite at the base of my tail a bit, and when I turned back, I was intrigued to see that Smokey was batting at a bag of food. He hit it once, twice, and on the third smack, toppled the thing out of the cupboard and onto the floor. I bit through the plastic and into some salty, crunchy things, which I ate hurriedly in case Smokey tried to come down for his share. He watched impassively from his perch and then smacked down another bag full of sweet, doughy rolls. I decided then and there that I had been wrong about Smokey all along. I almost felt bad about eating his cat food earlier, though it was hardly my fault that he didn't finish his meal when it was served. What did he expect would happen? I couldn't open the cupboards myself, The science somehow escaped me. I did, however, manage to snag a loaf of bread and pull it off the counter, carefully removing it from the package, which I chewed separately. The trash can in the kitchen didn't have a lid, so it was easy to access, though a few of the items, some bitter black grit that coated my tongue when I gave it an experimental lick, along with eggshells and plastic containers, were inedible. I chewed the plastic anyway. I was outside waiting when the bus pulled up, and although Chelsea and Todd both got off, there was no sign of the boy, which meant he would be arriving home with Mom. I went back into the house and pulled some shoes out of Mom's closet, though I didn't chew on them much because I was feeling pretty lethargic from all the snacks Smokey had given me. I stood in the living room trying to decide whether to lie on the couch, which no longer had any sun on it at all, or lie in the patch of sun on the carpet. It was a tough decision, and when I finally chose the sun, I lay down uneasily, not sure I'd picked the right thing. When Mom's car door slammed, I tore through the house into the garage and was out the dog door in an instant, wagging at the fence so no one would be the wiser. Ethan ran straight over to me and came into the yard to play with me while Mom went up the walk, her shoes clicking. "I missed you, Bailey. Did you have fun today?" the boy asked me, scratching under my chin. We gazed at each other in adoration. "Ethan, come look what Bailey did." At the sound of my name, pronounced so sternly, my ears fell. Somehow, Smokey and I had been found out. Ethan and I went into the house, and I approached Mom with my tail in full wag, so she'd forgive me. She was holding one of the shredded bags in her hand. The door to the garage was open. "Look what he did," Mom said. "Bailey, you are a bad dog, a bad dog." I hung my head. Though I'd technically done nothing wrong, I realized that Mom was mad at me. Ethan was too, particularly when he started to pick up the bits of plastic off the floor. "How in the world did he even get up on the counter? He must have jumped," Mom said. "You are a bad dog, a bad, bad dog, Bailey," Ethan told me again. Smokey strolled in, leaping languidly onto the counter. I gave him a glum look. He was a bad cat, a bad, bad cat. Amazingly, no one said anything to Smokey about his role as instigator. Instead, they gave him a fresh can of food. I sat expectantly, figuring I should at least get a dog biscuit, but everyone was still giving me cross looks. Mom pushed a mop around the floor, and the boy carried a bag of trash out into the garage. "Bailey, that was bad," the boy whispered to me again. Apparently everyone was having a much harder time getting over the incident than I was. I was still in the kitchen when I heard Mom shriek, "Bailey!" from the back of the house. I guessed she had found her shoes. Chapter 10. Over the course of the next year or two, I noticed that when the children all played together, Todd was often excluded. When he came around, an uneasiness went through the children, a mood change that Marshmallow and I could sense as easily as if one of them had screamed. Girls usually turned their backs on Todd, and the boys accepted him into their games with a noticeable reluctance. Ethan never went over to Todd's house anymore. Todd's older brother, Drake, rarely came outside except to get in his car and drive away, though Linda soon learned to ride a bicycle and pedaled it down the street to be with little girls her age almost every day. I took my cue from Ethan and never went near Todd again, though one snowy night when I was out in the backyard doing my business before bed, I could smell him standing on the other side of the fence, back in some trees. I let out a warning bark and was pretty pleased when I heard him turn around and run away. I didn't much care for the concept of school, which was what happened most mornings at home. I liked it better when summer came, and Mom and Ethan no longer had school, and we would go to the farm to live with Grandpa and Grandma. Whenever I arrived at the farm, I took off at a run, checking to see what was different and what was the same, marking my territory and reacquainting myself with Flair the horse, the mysterious black cat in the barn, and the ducks, who had irresponsibly decided to produce another batch of ducklings. I often could smell the skunk in the woods, but mindful of the unpleasantness of our last meetings, elected not to chase her down. If she wanted to play, she knew where to find me. One summer night, the whole family sat with me in the living room, far past normal bedtime, and everyone was excited, though Mom and Grandma were also afraid. And then they yelled and cheered, and Grandpa cried, and I barked, swept up in all the emotions. Humans are so much more complex than dogs, with such a broad range of feelings. Though there were many times I missed the yard, for the most part, I was now living a far richer life, even though I often didn't know what was going on. Ethan took me out into the night and gazed at the sky. "There's a man on the moon right now, Bailey. See the moon? Someday I'll go there, too." He radiated such happiness, I raced over and got a stick for him to throw for me. He laughed. "Don't worry, Bailey. I'll take you with me when I go." Sometimes Grandpa would go for a car ride into town, and the boy and I would accompany him. Before long, I had memorized a scent map of the entire trip. There was a moist smell that carried with it the distinct odor of stupid ducks and delicious rotting fish, followed a few minutes later by a powerfully pungent scent that filled the car. "Phew," Ethan often said.
"That's the goat ranch,"
Grandpa would always reply. With my head out the window, I often spied the goats, who were responsible for all the wonderful smells, and I would bark at them, though they were so dumb they never once fled in terror, but just stood there, staring like Flair the horse. Soon after the goat ranch, a great rattle would seize the car as we drove over a wooden bridge, and I would start wagging then, because I loved car rides to town, and the banging rumble noise meant we were almost there. Grandpa liked to go to a place where he sat in a chair, and a man played with his hair, and Ethan would get bored, and we'd wind up walking up and down the streets, looking at windows, and hoping to meet other dogs, which I assumed was the reason we were in town in the first place. The best location for dogs was in the park, which was a big, grassy area where people sat on blankets. There was a pond, but the boy didn't want me to swim in it. Everywhere in town I could smell the goat ranch. If I ever needed to catch my bearings, I would just turn my nose until the scent was the strongest, and that way lay home. One day we were in the park, and an older boy was throwing a plastic toy for his dog to catch. The dog was a black female, short and all business. When I trotted up to her, she completely ignored me, her eyes on the plastic toy, which was a thin, brightly colored disc. It would soar through the air, and she would run and leap and snag it before it even touched the ground, which I suppose was a pretty impressive trick if you like that sort of thing. "What do you think, Bailey? You want to do that, boy?" Ethan asked me. His eyes were shining as he watched the little dog catch the plastic disc, and when we got home, he went right to his room and got busy making what he called the flip. "It's like a cross between a boomerang, a frisbee, and a baseball," he told Grandpa. "It will fly twice as far because the ball gives it weight, see?" I sniffed at the object, which had been a perfectly good football, before Ethan cut it up and asked Grandma to put new stitches in it. "Come on, Bailey," the boy shouted. We raced outside. "How much money can you make on an invention like this?" the boy asked his Grandpa.
"Let's just see how she flies," Grandpa observed.
"Okay. Ready, Bailey? Ready?" I took this to mean that something was about to happen, and stood alertly. The boy cranked his arm back and flung the flip into the air, where it twisted and fell from the sky as if it had hit something.
I trotted off the porch and went over to sniff it. "Bring the flip, Bailey," the boy called. Gingerly, I picked the thing up. I remembered the short dog chasing the elegant flying disc in the park and felt a pang of envy. I took it back over to where the boy was standing and spat it out.
"Not aerodynamic," Grandpa was saying. "Too much resistance."
"I just need to throw it right," the boy said. Grandpa went back inside, and for the next hour, the boy practiced throwing the flip out into the yard, and I brought it back. I could sense a building despair in him, so one time, when he threw the flip and it flopped to the ground, I brought him back a stick instead. "No, Bailey," he said sadly. "The flip, get the flip." I barked, wagging, trying to get him to see just how fun the stick could be if he would give it a chance. "Bailey, the flip!" And then someone said, "Hi." It was a girl, Ethan's age. I trotted over to her, wagging, and she petted me on the head. In one hand she carried a covered basket containing some sweet-smelling breads, which really got my attention. I sat down, looking as attractive as possible, so she'd hand over what was in her basket. "What's your name, girl?" she asked me.
"He's a boy," Ethan said. "Name is Bailey."
I looked over at the boy, because he said my name, and saw that he was acting strange. It was almost as if he were afraid, but not exactly, though he had taken a half step back when he saw her. I looked back at the girl, who I really liked because of the rich-smelling biscuits in her basket. "I live down the road. My mom made some brownies for your family." The girl said, gesturing to her bicycle. "Oh," the boy said. I kept my attention on the basket. The girl said. "I'll get my grandma," the boy said. He turned and walked inside the house, but I elected to stay with the girl and her dog biscuits. "Hi, Bailey. Are you a good dog?" "You're a good dog," the girl told me. "Good, but not so good as to get a dog biscuit," I discovered, even though after a minute I gave the basket a nudge with my nose to remind her of the business at hand. Her hair was light-colored, and she brushed at it while she waited for Ethan to come back. She, too, seemed the tiniest bit afraid, though I could see nothing that would give anybody anxiety except a poor starving dog who needed a treat. "Hannah," Grandma said, coming out of the house. "It's so good to see you." "Hi, Mrs. Morgan." "Come in, come in. What have you got there?" "My mom made some brownies." "Well, isn't that wonderful? Ethan, you probably don't remember, but you and Hannah used to play together when you were just babies. She's a little more than a year younger than you."
"I don't remember," Ethan said, kicking at the carpet.
He was still acting oddly, but I felt duty-bound to guard the basket of dog biscuits, which Grandma set on a side table. Grandpa was sitting in his chair holding a book, and now he reached into the basket, looking over the tops of his glasses. "Do not spoil your dinner," Grandma hissed at him. He snatched his hand back, and he and I exchanged grieving looks. For the next several minutes, nothing much happened, biscuit-wise. Grandma did most of the talking, while Ethan stood with his hands in his pockets, and Hannah sat on the couch and didn't look at him. Finally, Ethan asked Hannah if she wanted to see the flip, and at the sound of the dreaded word, I whipped my head around and stared at him in disbelief. I had assumed we had ended that chapter of our lives. The three of us went out into the yard. Ethan showed Hannah the flip, but when he threw it, it still fell to the ground like a dead bird. "I need to make some design changes to it," Ethan said. I walked over to the flip, but didn't pick it up, hoping the boy would decide to end this embarrassment once and for all. Hannah stayed for a while, going over to the pond to look at the stupid ducks, petting Flair on the nose, and taking a couple of turns with the flip.
She got on her bicycle, and as she steered down the driveway, I trotted beside her. Then, when the boy whistled for me, returned at a dead run. Something told me we'd be seeing that girl again. Later that summer, too early in the season to go back home and go to school, in my opinion, Mom packed up the car. Ethan and I stood next to it as Grandma and Grandpa eased into their seats.
"I'll navigate," Grandpa said.
"You'll fall asleep before we cross the county line," Grandma replied.
"Now, Ethan, you are a big boy. You be good. You call if you have any problems." Ethan squirmed under his mother's hug.
"I know," he said.
"We'll be back in 2 days. You need anything, you can ask Mr. Huntley next door. I made you a casserole."
"I know," Ethan said.
"Bailey, you take good care of Ethan, okay?" I wagged my tail in cheerful non-comprehension. Were we going for a car ride or what?
"I stayed by myself all the time when I was his age," Grandpa said. "This will be good for him."
I could feel worry and hesitation in Mom, but eventually she got behind the wheel.
"I love you, Ethan," Mom said.
Ethan muttered something, kicking at the dirt. The car rolled off down the driveway, and Ethan and I solemnly watched it go.
"Come on, Bailey,"
he shouted when it was out of sight. We ran into the house. Everything was suddenly more fun. The boy ate some lunch, and when he was done, he put the plate on the floor for me to lick. We went into the barn, and he climbed up on the rafters while I barked, and when he jumped into a pile of hay, I tackled him. An inky shadow from the corner told me the cat was watching all of this, but when I trotted over to investigate, she slid off and vanished. I became uneasy when Ethan unlocked the gun cabinet, something he had never done without Grandpa being there. Guns made me nervous. They reminded me of when Todd threw a firecracker and it banged so close to me I felt a percussion against my skin. But Ethan was so excited I couldn't help but prance around at his feet. He put some cans on a fence and shot the gun, and the cans went flying. I couldn't quite understand the connection between the cans and the loud bang of the gun, but knew it was somehow all related, and judging from the boy's reaction, gloriously fun. Flair snorted and trotted to the far end of her yard, distancing herself from all the commotion. After the boy made dinner by warming up some succulent chicken, we sat in the living room, and he put on the television and ate off of a plate in his lap, tossing me pieces of skin. Now, this kind of fun I understood. At that moment, I didn't care if Mom ever came back. After I licked the plate which the boy left on the floor, I decided to test the new rules and climbed up in Grandpa's soft chair, looking over my shoulder to see if I'd draw the expected down command. The boy just stared at the television, so I curled up for a nap. I drowsily registered the telephone ringing and heard the boy say, "Bed." But when he hung up, he didn't go to bed. He sat back down to watch more television. I was in a solid sleep when a sudden sense of something wrong roused me with a jolt. The boy was sitting stiffly upright, his head cocked.
"Did you hear a noise?"
he whispered at me. I debated whether the urgency I sensed in his voice meant that my nap was over. I decided that what was needed was a calming influence and lowered my head back on the soft cushion. From within the house, there was a light thump.
"Bailey,"
the boy hissed. Okay, this was serious. I got off the chair, stretched, and looked at him expectantly. He reached down and touched my head, and his fear leaped from his skin.
"Hello?" he called. "Is someone there?"
He froze, and I emulated his posture on high alert. I wasn't at all sure what was happening, but I knew there was a threat. When another thump caused him to jump, fright rippling over his skin, I prepared myself to face whatever or whoever was the problem. I could feel the fur rising on my back, and I gave a low growl of warning. At the sound of my growl, the boy moved soundlessly across the room. I shuffled after him, still alert, and watched as he opened the gun cabinet for the second time that day.
Chapter 11.
Holding Grandpa's rifle in his trembling hands, the boy crept up the stairs, down the hall, and into Mom's bedroom. I was right on his heels. Ethan checked her bathroom and under the bed, and when he whipped the closet door open, he yelled, "Ha!" scaring me half to death. We repeated this examination in the boys' room, Grandma and Grandpa's room, and the small room with the couch where Grandma slept when Grandpa made his loud rumbling noises at night. Before leaving on the car ride, Grandma had been in this room doing more work on the flip, trying to fix it at Ethan's direction, and it was called the sewing room. The boy checked the whole house, Grandpa's gun out in front of him, and he rattled every knob and tested every window. Passing through the living room, I walked hopefully over